Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
This week, we start off with dietitian Kim Airy talking about how to handle your food intake as we approach holiday season. Now that summer is over, it's very easy to get carried away with pounding back extra calories you don't need. Our social media expert, Patrick Charles, is here talking about viral videos. We speak to Canadian singer-songwriter Matthew Genovese about his burgeoning career and why he chose to leave Canada for Los Angeles. We wrap things up with relationship coach Frank Kermit talking about committed relationships and what exactly does that mean.
Capture your need for sound.
Thanksgiving is the time of year to be reflective and think about all the things that you are thankful for. For most of us, though, it's the perfect excuse to get together with family and friends and celebrate. What better way to celebrate than with a delicious turkey dinner? But is there a way to enjoy Thanksgiving while not overindulging? Our dietitian Kim Airy joins us to talk about ways to enjoy your Thanksgiving feast without overdoing it. Kim, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you and I have talked about this before, but I feel like we're getting into holiday season. In a way. So how can we try to avoid overeating? Because I think in the summer, you know, everyone's sort of on a mission to be slim and trim, and then things fall by the wayside when you head into autumn.
I think part of what happens in the autumn is we start to want to have different kinds of foods. And certainly seasonally, different foods are available. So there's more, you know, we want to cook our potatoes and have our soups and our stews, and we want to have some, you know, nice, really yummy things. Whereas in the summer, we're really happy having a big salad and eating a lot of fruit. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to do that in the winter, right? So I think that's the first thing that's different. Just understanding that every year we make that transition, and not to panic that it's not the end of the world, that you no longer feel like eating salad. And it's okay. It's really healthy to have soups, and it's really healthy to be eating your vegetables in a different format. You can have them cooked. You don't have to have them always raw. Just knowing that can help to calm some people down so they don't feel like they're losing control. Because sometimes it's that feeling like we're losing control that makes us kind of say, well, since I'm already not doing really well, who cares if I have this other thing that's even worse, right?
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to turkey in and of itself, you know, here in Canada, obviously we've celebrated it, and, you know, our friends down south, it's coming up for them in November. And when it comes to turkey, you know, I think a lot of us are like, woo, turkey, because we don't get it that often, you know, maybe twice a year, maybe three times if you're doing the Easter thing. But it's so easy, I think, for people to go back for second and thirds. What do you say to that? Because I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with turkey leftovers, knowing like, oh, you can have it, you know, on Monday or Tuesday and get it eaten up before it goes bad.
Well, I think the one thing to remember is that turkey is one of the leanest and healthiest meats to eat. So that's the good news.
Okay.
It's what we do to the turkey that sometimes messes it up. It's pouring a liter of gravy on it, that's a problem. It's taking the sides that we take and we add, you know, roast the vegetables and pour maple syrup on them and big dessert afterwards. It's kind of what comes with the turkey that's more the issue than the actual turkey itself. So I think the first thing I'll say is remember turkey is pretty healthy. Then look at what you're doing to it. What are you cooking it with? Are you making, you know, stuffing and potatoes and rice, and how many starches are you serving with it? Maybe you only need to serve one. Look at your recipes. Is there some way you can take your recipes and make sure you're adding, you know, have a choice of two or three vegetables to have with it? And take some of those. I mean, there's really amazing recipes that you can find everywhere now for vegetables that make them taste really, really, really great. But at the same time, they're not, you know, smothered in a ton of butter or fried or whatever that's adding a lot of calories. So, you know, I have a favorite recipe that I usually make when I'm making my turkey. There's two vegetable dishes that the family really enjoy. And, you know, one of them is Brussels sprouts, which I, you know, chop up and add some onions to, and some chicken broth to, and some garlic and even some pecans. And it's really delicious. And I have another recipe that's with other vegetables, parsnips and beets and carrots. And again, it's really delicious. So when you load up your plate with all the veggies that are going to be lower in calories than some of the other things, you're not loading up as much. I think the other thing we want to do is we want to set a really nice table and look at our dishes. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to talk about food for a second. I'm going to talk about dishes. These big white dishes that everybody has that have no rims drive me absolutely insane. And they've just published another study about them saying that when you see your food on a big plate that has no rims, you have this illusion that you're having a small portion.
Okay.
It makes an optical illusion on the plate, and you go, oh my God, that'll never satisfy me. Wow. So then you fill up your plate, and you add more, and then you end up, then after the meal, you go, oh my God, I ate too much, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is if you take a plate that's got a big rim, you know, a nice thick rim, and it's a dark colored, you don't want to cover that rim up. You just put your food in the center of the plate, and it makes your portions look bigger to your eyes. And because you eat with your eyes first, you actually take less and go, wow, that's going to be more than enough to fill me up. So, you know, check what dishes are you using. Are your dishes all white? I mean, after I saw that study, I went dish shopping.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And this is an actual, like, study they did in a university, you know, observing people. And there's been more than one that really, when you have a plate that doesn't have a rim on it, mm-hmm. and then it's the bigger the plate, the more you're going to eat. So scale down your plates.
Wow. That's really interesting. That's really interesting. I hope people take that to heart. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show, our dietitian, Kim Airy. You can learn more about her on her website, kimairy.com. Kim, how do you get back on track, or at least keep yourself, even maybe, let's say, during the holidays? I know, because it won't be long before we're heading into office Christmas parties and all that kind of stuff. Our American Thanksgiving. So how do you keep yourself on track? Does one thing set you off and then you're screwed?
Well, I think, again, it's how you think about it, okay? So a lot of times people will have that one thing and they'll kind of go, oh, my God, I have 6 Christmas parties. I already messed up the first one, so who cares if I mess up the next ones? Or when you're actually at the Christmas party and you set this lofty goal of I'm not going to have any this and I won't have dessert and I won't do this and I won't do that and I won't do the other. And then you have these really, really lofty goals, and then, you know, you kind of fall flat, and then you kind of go, why bother? I think there's really 2 things that I try and get my clients to do. One is to set really realistic goals. So, you know, make sure things, and then the next thing is to kind of be really mindful and get to know yourself. So when I say that, I mean things, for instance, like know yourself. So some of those, you know, when I go to the Christmas parties, usually when we go to the restaurants, the desserts are the least fabulous part of the meal, right? It's a piece of cake that, I don't know, sheet cake, I think. I don't know. It's just not fabulous, at least where I've been going. Well, I don't eat that dessert because I don't really like it. Like, why waste calories on something I don't really like?
Mm-hmm.
So learn to understand that. You don't have to eat the dessert just because it's there. Learn to understand. Learn to know your likes and your dislikes. If you think you're going to be really hungry when you get there, maybe you want to do something like have a salad before you go to the party because you know you're going to be eating late so you won't be starving, and that way you're going to manage your appetite a little bit better. And I think the one thing I try and get everybody to remember and to really focus on is whatever happens at the Christmas party, the next day, go back to normal.
Okay.
If you can go back to normal the next day, that's half the battle. The biggest issue is the prolonged, you know, every day there's something. So if you can go back to normal the next day, that's half the battle. And sometimes the normal is going to be to say, well, I have 2 Christmas parties in a row, so the only way I can do anything about it is I'm going to do a bit of extra exercise to compensate. Or this week is a write-off and, you know, it's going to be, or this weekend is a write-off and Monday is when I go back to normal. But theoretically, Christmas parties are only suppers, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Or only breakfast or whatever. There's only one meal of the day. So theoretically, you can eat well the other meals of the day.
And I think it's really important what you said about getting back on track, because I think so many people are like, oh, I screwed up, so let's just keep screwing up. And the thing, too, is like, I don't think everything is always a write-off, because I mean, if you want to say this is my treat or my cheat or whatever it is, but I think you should still have some sort of sense of decorum and responsibility about saying, hey, I don't need to eat all of this just because it's the annual Christmas party.
Well, and I think it's really, that's where the mindfulness comes in, where you know what you like and what you don't like. And I mean, it's really easy for you to say, I don't want to have anything to drink if you actually don't like anything they're offering you.
Right.
Or it's if you know, for example, I have one client who knows they go to a big party at Christmas and they know there's an open bar and so he can get, you know, drinks for before dinner, there's wine during dinner, and then there's, you know, drinks after dinner. And he finds all that does is make sure he's, like, good and drunk, and then when he's good and drunk, he also eats really, you know, God knows, he eats mm-hmm. way too much and not the right things. So what does he do? He makes sure that before dinner he has, you know, Virgin Caesars and non-alcoholic beverages. He's always got a drink in his hand, so nobody bothers him, but it's not anything that's going to set anything in motion. And because he's able to do that, he's been able to say, well, you know, at supper time, maybe I'll skip a course or I'll leave something on my plate. And then all he has to be, even if you eat something that's not, I don't know, let's say they bring you the entree is chicken wings. Well, even if you only eat two instead of eating all six of them, they bring to you. That's still, as opposed to saying, oh, there's chicken wings, that's no good for me. Oh, well, if I eat two, I may as well eat eight. No. If you eat two, that's great. It's a good step forward. And then you can go on to the next course and eat a little bit of that.
Can you also, I guess, maybe refresh our minds about the alcohol? Because I think, again, it's something like, oh, it's liquid. It can't be doing any, you know, harm or adding the calories, but it is.
Oh, it is. It is. And I'm never too sure what's worse, the alcoholic beverages, because alcohol does contain calories. I mean, and there's as much calories in 12 ounces of beer as there is, or 355 milliliters of beer, as there is in, you know, 3 to 4 or 5 ounces of wine, depending on the kind of wine, and is an ounce and a half of hard liquor. So it doesn't take a lot to make a lot of calories. Then what you mix it with, you know, if you're mixing it with fruit juice or if you're mixing it with a soft drink, that's adding even more calories, or God forbid cream, you know, because mm-hmm. some of the drinks are cream based. That makes it even worse. I think the other thing that we want to remember about alcohol is it decreases your inhibitions. So when you have no inhibitions, then when somebody offers you some chips or some whatevers, that's, you know, or you're sitting down and the bowl of chips is next to you, you're going to have a lot more difficulty to say, no, I don't want to eat any.
Yep.
So that's the other issue you have to be really careful of, because sometimes it's not the calories in the alcohol that get you, it's the calories in what you ate extra that really add up.
Okay, perfect. And before I let you go, you know, our friends to the south still going to be celebrating Thanksgiving. It hasn't obviously arrived yet. What would you want to put in their head with regards to the dinner itself? Like, is there a vegetable or a fruit or something where you know, they could think about replacing the stock Thanksgiving foods that we all have? Like, is there a way of them thinking differently as they prepare for this Thanksgiving?
There's, I guess, two things I would leave you with. One is to remember that if there's 10 people sitting at your table, 5 of them are sitting there with you going, oh my goodness, I hope she's serving a lighter dinner because I'm worried about my cholesterol, my diabetes, my triglycerides, my weight, my something. Mm-hmm. Fully 50% of the population, if not more, is worried about these things. So you're not the only one who's trying to be more health conscious. So go ahead and make changes. Nobody's going to be really upset. The other thing I'm going to suggest is search the internet for amazing recipes. There are some sites I go to. My two favorite go-to websites are www.cookinglight.com and the other one is eatingwell.com. And they have extensive and years of recipes from holiday seasons that have been lightened and, you know, added, freshened up so that they have more nutrition and less calories and they're better for you. And they build on our old favorite standards, both from Canada and the US. So they're really great sites to go to.
Perfect. Kim, thank you as always. You always have great advice for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoy. Happy Thanksgiving.
That is our dietitian, Kim Airy. Again, for more information, you can check her out on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com, as well as her own, KimAiry.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
A song from Kanye West's 2005 sophomore album Late Registration debuts on Billboard's Top 100 Songs at number 18 thanks to viral video by writer and comedian Marina Shifton. The video shows her dancing around an empty office as subtitles offer the reasons why that she is quitting her job. Is this the way promotion is headed? Is viral the way to go. Talking about all of this is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, thanks for joining us again this week.
Anytime. How you doing?
Good. I'm good. So I'm actually really excited about this. So from 2005, that's many years ago.
Yeah.
She has like reignited the late registration fame for this guy.
Yeah, it's crazy. Actually, one of the other interesting facts is I believe so far the song has debuted higher than anything from his Yeezus album.
Wow!
Like it jumped on the chart at number 18, and like stuff from Yeezus was climbing for a little bit. But pretty interesting, right? 2005, so it's almost a 10-year-old song, and it's back on the Billboard chart.
That's awesome. And is this sort of good news or bad news for the music business, you think?
Well, it's funny, right? Because you gotta wonder. It's like it's good news in a way because obviously it shows you that even if a song is old, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that it's commercially not viable anymore. But I think the bad thing is that it also shows you that they can't really control what becomes a hit.
Right.
As much as people, in the 90s and in the 80s, we used to believe that, they can, make a hit. They can pick the right record and the right person and just invent a hit. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, the video isn't, it's not like it's a professionally shot video. It was like a gag. Like basically this girl was fed up with her job and figured she would film herself dancing around the office to this song, Gone. And with the subtitles, you see, the reasons why and what sucks about the company and all this, right? But that's what made it popular. People loved that. But, you got to think to yourself, is there an artist who could make a video like this and make it seem like it's an authentic viral video mm-hmm. without it looking phony? Like it's impossible to do. So it's kind of good news in one sense, and it's bad news on the other hand.
It's weird how that sort of, because like reality TV, if we just go there for a second, like, so much, obviously it's so slick and it's so produced and it's so this and so that. So it's not really reality TV, even though that's what they're going for. But like actually get like a real video from some schmo in like wherever, like I remember, I think, and I'm sure you saw this several months back. It might've been even at the end of 2012 where that father in like, I want to say like Tennessee or Kentucky or something, his daughter had like backtalked him or something, so he shot her computer.
Right, I did see that.
Like that thing went, they had it on all the morning networks. They interviewed the dad and like all this kind of stuff, and like that went bananas. Like so, it almost is like you're looking for like the regular Joe to sort of like I can see why people would like this specific thing about the Kanye West thing, because so many people hate their job. Like it was probably empowering for them.
Yeah, absolutely. But you got to think. I mean, you made me think of something. Like if that dad, right, when he shot the computer, mm-hmm. if he was on the Today Show the week after, it would have been so cool if all of a sudden they said to him, like, so, like, what are you up to now? And he said, well, I got a new album coming out.
Yeah.
It drops on Tuesday. That would have been amazing.
He probably would have done better than Miley Cyrus. So what does this say, though, I guess, in the grand scheme of things about the power of, like, a crowd to make this
Yeah,
happen?
Well, the crowd is really who speaks when and makes things happen when you think about it, because that's just it. People went out and bought the song. I mean, look, the same thing happened with the finale of Breaking Bad. They used a song from the band Badfinger from like the 70s, and that song popped on the iTunes charts again because everybody downloaded the song right after they watched the show on TV. And it's pretty amazing because it just goes to show you that people want to make a connection with things and that nobody can really be forced into it.
Right. And is this like a sign of resurgence in video? Because, for example, I know that Sean Diddy Combs has launched that video channel now, Revolt or Revolt TV or something. I don't even know exactly how it's doing, but are people heading back more? Because it almost seems like, I don't know, like I barely watch videos anymore. And I remember I used to have like BET on 24/7 catching my favorite jams.
But you know what's interesting? I think there has been over the last few years, I think there has been a massive resurgence in video.
Okay.
When you think about the fact that, first of all, mobile, right?
Right.
I mean, you can watch things on your phone, you can watch things on your iPad. That's what people are doing now. And I think that it's made videos much more relevant. And now with YouTube, the fact that people can shoot what they want to shoot and upload what they want to upload and then share it, I think that is really making a resurgence in video. Because just for myself, I think I've probably watched more music videos this year than I've watched in like a really long time.
Wow. Oh, okay.
But I do find myself watching music videos.
That's cool. It's funny because I just saw a clip from the new Avril Lavigne, Chad Kroeger song, which the song's great, by the way. Have you heard it? Like, I really...
No.
It's really good. And it's funny to, because we all know they're married now, but it's a really great, it's a really great song. And I saw just a clip of it. I haven't seen the whole thing, but just seeing that clip and just knowing that they're together, it's made me want to go go watch the video, which I don't think has been officially released yet. I think Good Morning America had the rights to sort of put it up on their website first.
Right, right.
But it's weird because I was was like, and I'm not even like a huge Avril fan, but I've been playing the song on the radio station that I work for, and like it's under my skin, and it's great to know that these two, you know, because I think a lot of people were like, oh, when they got married, this could be a disaster waiting to happen. But their collaboration seems like it's a really good song.
That's cool. That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I think, like you said, I mean, it makes you want to go look at the video, right?
Right.
And I think the fact that you can like dial up things now on your own, I think makes another huge difference. Because now, you know, we talk about this video, the girl who put it up, her name is Marina Shifton, mm-hmm. and she's a comedian. She's a writer and a comedian, or an aspiring comedian, I should say. And she's got some stuff, some projects that she's working on now. So if you go Google her, you can A, watch the video, and B, see what she's up to. So I think it's a little bit more enticing now, because I remember back in the days when you used to have to wait to see the video that you wanted to see. Like you said, you'd put BET on or Much Music or MTV, and you'd say, oh, I hope they play the new whatever video. Mm-hmm. And you'd sit around all afternoon waiting to see it.
Yes,
but,
exactly.
But now if I tell you about a video, you can just go call it up on YouTube and watch it, or on Vevo.
Yeah, exactly. And do you think that this girl, this Miss Shifton, has she tapped into something bigger than just sort of worker fatigue and you know, being sort of dissatisfied or unfulfilled with work?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think that it's almost like it's a weird fantasy that people have. You know, you go to work every day and you know, you're working for somebody else, and you wish you could sort of, I don't know, trash the office or something sometimes. And I think that her dancing around her office and quitting her job, I think it really struck a chord with people. So on a couple of different levels, I mean, you know, the music connects with people, you know, what she's actually doing connects with people. So I think it's something very interesting. And don't be surprised if like record companies start, you know, paying people to like do things at their job. Like, you know, we'll give you $1,000 if you film yourself knocking over your boss's desk, and we're going to use it in that new Avril Lavigne video.
Right. Do you think there's going to be like copycat videos of what she has done by because you know that Harlem Shake thing went nuts. Like we even did at Virgin Radio, like where I worked, we did our own version, and we got like, I don't even remember how many hits we're up to, but like the last I checked, I think it was over 6,000 or 10,000 hits that we got just for our Virgin version of Harlem Shake. So could this be something that, like, you know, people would take on, like the sort of I hate my job and let's play Kanye West song?
I think absolutely. And I'll tell you first an interesting fact. Mm-hmm. I've never watched a Harlem Shake video.
You have never watched a Harlem Shake video?
I don't even know what it is, because I'm offended by how popular it became.
Oh my God.
So I've never seen a Harlem Shake
There's
video.
A couple of good ones, I have to tell you. Like, especially.
No, there are no good ones.
There's no
good. There can't be. It's impossible. I will not watch one.
Okay.
I'm very
well,
proud of that
good.
Record. I've
very
never
nice.
Seen one. But here's the thing, the company that she quit, they did a response video. They used the same song.
Okay.
And they used it as a hiring video. Like, they use it as a promo for their company.
Oh my God, that, seriously?
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, seriously. That's and that has got, crazy. That has already got like 5 million views.
Wow. And it's because I thought you were going to tell me they had sued her or something, because they always like to sue people in the States. So that's funny. I wanted to tell you something, and I think people can find this on my Facebook page. And I think you liked it. What did you think of my cow photobomb picture?
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
And it's funny because that I think is something where, and it's funny because I got over whatever, like, you know, 40 hits or 40 likes or whatever. And it was funny because I think that plays into what we just talked about with her. Like, it's like it's something funny and it's something real and it's not, you know, contrived or like.
Well, that's just it. Because, you know, anything with like, animal photobombs, I think, are the funniest thing in the world because it's difficult to do. I mean, I know you have access.
Yeah.
But still.
It's funny because, like, I love photobomb pictures I just, or, you know, or even if someone places themselves in a funny position and whatever. But it's funny because I think, like, even when I'm looking on the internet for stuff to post on our station Facebook page, like, you're always just, I always look for sort of real things or funny statements or something, because that's what gets shared the most. That's what gets liked the most. So that's why I could
Absolutely.
See why this viral video, or turned viral, I should say, is because of that realness of it.
Yeah. I think you should make it your profile picture.
Yeah. I should. I'm going to have to get clearance from the cow if she's cool with me. Sure. Patrick, thanks so much for hanging out again this week.
Anytime. I'll see you next time.
That is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Again, check him out on our website, kellyalexandershow.com, and follow him on Twitter @getpatrick.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Canadian singer-songwriter Matthew Genovese, who is releasing an EP called Chasing the Sun. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you?
I am great. Thank you so much for making time for us today. And, you know, right off the hop, I have to ask you, was being in music a career that you've worked on since childhood, or did you just sort of not fall into it, but did sort of the path lead you that way, or was this like a planned thing?
It was not really a planned thing. I mean, I've been doing it for so long that it's kind of planned now, I guess. When I was 9, I got my first guitar for my birthday, and I started playing. I kind of played it every day, but I wasn't like, it wasn't apparent to me at that time that it was going to be my career choice. And then around probably grade 6 is when I kind of, you know, I had like a moment where I just decided that was what I was going to do. And from then on, I like everything in my entire life had to do with music. And over the next couple of years, I played hockey and I played a lot of sports when I was a kid. And I slowly kind of had to start making choices like, oh, I got to, you know, either be in the studio 5 times a week or I got to be on the ice 5 times a week. So I decided that, you know, if I had to pick one, music was going to be the one that I was going to do. So yeah, everything from the time I was like probably 10, I guess, has had to do with music.
I wanted to ask you about growing up in Toronto. Do you think that has influenced the way your music is and how you go about doing it? Because, you know, for some people looking at Toronto, it really is sort of it's the mecca, I would say, of all commercial, you know, arts and stuff, yeah. If you think about it. I know a lot of people, obviously, mm-hmm. You know, we're in Montreal right now, or I am talking to you. A lot of people feel like Montreal is artsy fartsy. Where do you feel that Toronto fits in your growth as a musician?
I don't know if I can say how much it really affected me as a person, but I know, like, inspiration-wise, I like the fact that, especially living in LA now, I miss having like 4 seasons. So I like the fact that Toronto has, you know, a very distinctive summer and winter and spring and fall. So it kind of lends itself to writing, I guess. I like to write, I don't know why, but I like to write when it's snowing or raining, anytime there's any type of precipitation, which barely ever happens in LA, other than today, actually. But yeah, I don't know if it actually had an influence on my sound. As far as, I mean, other than Canadian acts, I love Ron Sexsmith. I grew up listening to Ron Sexsmith. I love, you know, a lot of Canadian music. So a lot of Canadian music has an effect on me, but I don't know if Toronto as a city really affected me. I don't know. I've never really thought about it before.
And you brought up Los Angeles, and I wanted to talk about that. Why did you make the move to LA? I know that some people do. Like, I've interviewed Anjali in the past, and she's told me that she sort of splits her time like it sounds like you do. But why did you pick LA instead of New York? And I guess, why did you do it to begin with? Is it because of that's where everyone is?
Yeah, it's kind of like the center of popular music, I guess. It was never really... When I was a kid, I always loved New York, and I love New York now. But for some reason, I went to Berklee College of Music in Boston. So I went to school in the States, and I kind of got a feel for it. And I've been to New York a lot, and I spent a lot of time in Nashville. So it was kind of in between Nashville and L.A. was where I was deciding. And I had recorded an EP in L.A., and I kind of fell in love with the place. So that was one big reason for moving here. But another reason for moving to America, you know, in general, other than the music industry, was going to school in the States, and, you know, all my Berklee friends, all my musician friends have all moved here, so it's kind of, you know, all my friends live here, and this is kind of where the music industry is based, and it's good weather, so it made sense.
Is it hard for you to be a Canadian and be down there? Like, is it hard for you to get work? Because I'm not sure how that works. Do you have a green card, or are you fortunate with, like, a dual citizenship?
Yeah, I have an O-1 visa, so it's an artist visa, so it allows me to do anything within my, you know, musical career. But it's not easy to do, and it takes a long time to kind of figure out, you know, fill out the application and apply and find a sponsor, and yeah, it's a lot of work.
Okay, gotcha. And so have you found lots of other fellow Canadians down there, or are you sticking, like you said, mainly with a lot of your Berklee friends?
Yeah, actually, I have a lot of Canadian friends. There's actually a band from Toronto called Magic, and they just signed Sony, and they're all from Toronto, and they all moved down here. Nads, really lead singer, writes for Justin Bieber a lot. He's part of the Messengers, which is like a production group. So they're all my friends. I knew Ben, who's played bass. He played bass for me in Toronto for years. So yeah, a lot of my friends here are from Toronto. You'd be surprised about how many Canadians I run into.
That's awesome. I actually went to school in Toronto, and I have a bunch of friends that went down to Los Angeles too, so it's kind of interesting to see where everyone goes. And just sort of a final geography question, if you will. How often do you come back to Canada, and is it important for you to sort of keep, you know, some roots alive here as well?
Yeah, I spend about, you know, usually works out maybe a little less than half my time is spent in Toronto, but it's never like you know, 6 months there, 6 months here. It's usually like, you know, I usually always come to Toronto for the summer. I spent my summers in Muskoka outside of Toronto growing up, so I definitely like to go there and get out of the city and kind of, I do a lot of writing up in Muskoka. So I definitely do that every year, and then I come back whenever I have events or, you know, the film festival or Canadian Music Week or anything like that. I come back, and, you know, I have family there, so I come back to visit them.
Cool. Can you talk to us about your EP, Chasing the Sun? What do you want fans and potential new fans to pull from it? Like, is there themes? Is it a collection of songs?
It's got five songs that I've written in the past probably 2 years. I recorded it in Nashville, and I produced it with two guys that are in Nashville, Robin Eaton and Brad Jones. And yeah, it was just kind of five songs that I had written. You know, I write every day, so I have a lot of songs. So it was just kind of, I picked kind of the five songs that would go best together, and I recorded them in November of last year. And I just had a song remixed by, not like a remix, but like another mixing engineer did a version of it. Tony Maserati, who's a pretty big mixing engineer. He mixed like Blurred Lines for Robin Thicke and a lot of big records.
That's awesome. And I wanted to ask you as well about the lead single, which has already been released, If I Can't Have You. Was it a hard choice to sort of pick that? Because I often interview artists, and sometimes, you know, they'll tell me sort of, it's hard to pick between my babies. Like, do you view your songs as your babies?
Yeah, I'm like that. I write for other artists, and I produce for other artists. So I kind of have the ability to put on the marketing hat and kind of go, this is the one, you know, even though this is my favorite song, this is the one that should go on the radio and that will catch people's attention better. But when I first wrote that song, that was kind of my view. And that was the first song I think that I wrote that kind of set the stage for how the rest of the EP was going to sound. I wrote that in London with an Australian artist named Alex Lloyd, who had a big song in Australia. It was like, I think it was the number one played song or sold song in Australian history or something. He like beat out Elvis or something crazy in Australia. It's called Amazing, his song.
Wow, that's really cool. And I wanted to ask you as well, who do you identify the most with as like a fellow artist, whether that's past or current? And is there an artist or a producer that you would love to collaborate with?
Yeah, there's a producer that I would love to collaborate. I guess I use this one since he's from the Toronto area, would be Daniel Lanois. I mean, I think one day, I've always thought my two favorite artists and the way, in terms of their music and how they sit down and write and how they kind of, their whole philosophy about music and the way that they live their lives and everything, have been Paul Simon and Sting. Those two kind of guys have always been to me, because, you know, it's like no matter how much older they get and how much better they get, they always seem to keep on learning. You know, it's like Sting can play, you know, every instrument. He never musically fluent. Like he'll master one thing, and then right when you think he's done it all, he comes out with a classical winter record, and you're like, it just comes out of left field. So he's very, I like the fact that he never kind of limits himself, and once he kind of completes one area of music, he kind of moves on and never stops.
Right. That's actually a really good person to sort of want to identify with, because I think you're right. I think he's one artist that can get away with doing a lot of different things and people won't get angry at him. Because it's funny how like certain artists, if they try something else, all of a sudden their main core fan base has a fit. So
yeah, because it kind of doesn't, I feel like it's not authentic. I feel like people, it's not like he's chasing a fad. You know, I've heard him say, he always says, you know, music is its own gift, and its reward is playing it, not the success that you get from playing it. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, it's kind of looking at music like, now what's the next big thing that's going to, you know, be popular on YouTube or something. It's kind of like, you know, what haven't I done yet? That's kind of what it's like.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask you, where do you see your career going? Like, what do you want to accomplish in the next, you know, 8 months to a year? And in the future, like, what's the big goal? Is it stadiums? Is it, you know, like, what do you want?
Yeah, I mean, well, playing in stadiums would be great. I'm happy, you know, writing my music and playing it on tour, you know, whether it's stadiums or small venues. I like doing both, kind of big gigs and small ones. And I love writing with other people and producing for other people, because I kind of like, I feel like as an artist, I have a specific, you know, direction and sound, but I have so many other interests. And for a long time, that kind of, it was very hard for me to become an artist because it was hard for me to find who I was because I had so many different interests. And I love, you know, top 40 just as much as I love, you know, blues from 1900. So like, it was very confusing to me to try to push it all together and make one artist that was like everything, which is kind of impossible to do. So I just decided to kind of separate my artist thing and do my production thing. And so what I would like to do is kind of be able to have the best of both worlds. Somebody like Ryan Tedder is a good example from One Republic. He produces for other people and writes, you know, for other people, but he also has his own band. And in, also the next, I'm in the middle of writing a full album right now. So probably in January, February, I should be recording or finished recording a new album, and I should be coming out with that.
That's amazing. And I think it's really great, Matthew, that you have such a good sense of what other people are doing and where you need to get to fulfill your goals. Because I think the Ryan Tedder example is a great example. And for my listeners who don't know, Ryan Tedder obviously does a bunch of things for Beyonce and Adele and all that kind of stuff, as well as his One Republic work. So that's fantastic. And you brought up writing for other artists. I just wanted to ask you, is there an artist right now that you would love to say, oh my God, record my song?
I mean, Canadians, Justin Bieber would be one. I don't know, Serena Ryder, I love her. I love, let me think, I mean, anybody really. I love everything from hip-hop to, you know, Katy Perry to Sting, so.
That's fantastic. That's great. Well, Matthew, I want to thank you for your time. Thank you so much. It's been really great to speak with you.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That is Matthew Genovese. Make sure to check him out on his website and learn more about his music and all that sort of good stuff on his website, MatthewGenovese.com.
Hey, it's Matthew Genovese, and you're listening to The Kelly Alexander Show.
I'm packing my bags, then I'm gone, gone, gone. Before the sun comes up today, I've sat here too long, watching the world fly by. Now's my chance to run away. If I can't have you, I don't wanna be here. I don't wanna be here. If you're too scared to love, I don't wanna be here. I don't wanna be here. You started a fire. Now everything's gone, gone, gone. I watch the ashes blow away. If you're moving on and there's no give and take, then there's no reason left.
Relationships of any kind are hard, but what if you are in a relationship where your partner isn't committed to you? Is it worth staying in that relationship, or should you break it off and start again? Relationship coach Frank Kermit joins us to talk about commitment within a relationship. Frank, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. Always a pleasure to be here.
So at what stage should couples make a commitment to one another? Is it after a certain amount of years, or is it like a feeling that comes over you? Like, how do you take things to the next level?
Believe it or not, time together is not the most important factor. Whether a couple's been together for only a couple of days, a couple of weeks, or even a few years, time is not the issue. The issue is, what is your life plan? And whether or not your partner is able to support that life plan. That is the deciding factor. If your partner does not have the same life plan as you or isn't ready to support that life plan as you, it doesn't matter how long you've been together. It signals that this relationship may not have a future.
What are some of the signs that your partner is not committed to you?
Well, in one thing, defining what stage you are at your relationship. Are you just friends with benefits? Are you dating exclusively? Are you dating non-exclusively? Is this person your primary partner, assuming you want to practice open relationships? You do have to give a title, a level, a designation to the type of relationship you're in. If your partner doesn't want to take you out to a corporate event for their company and say, this is my partner, this is my significant other, that might be a sign. If you're going to go out, you know, public displays of affection are very important. And I'm not talking about holding hands or hugging or anything, but if your partner is going out to a wedding and doesn't invite you along as an official date and introduces you as just a friend, that might be an indication that your partner is not that serious about you. And if you're both on the same page about that, that's okay. It's when one person says, I want this to get them more serious, and the other person says, I'm not ready for that. Quantify it. When will you be ready? What criteria are you looking for? What is holding you back? And if the person says, well, I don't know what's holding me back, that's a red flag.
When it comes to commitment, how is it best to bring up the subject of it? Do you need to go in talking to your partner saying, are we going to become engaged? Like, do you have to have a clear idea about what your level of commitment is that you're talking about to your partner?
100%. Look, the best way to talk about commitment is directly and calmly.
Okay.
Just simply say, look, I want to know what your life plan is. That's probably one of the better questions you can start with. What's your life plan? Where do you see yourself in 5 years, in 10 years, and so on? And if you are thinking about wanting to start a family, see if your life plan regarding starting a family is the same as your partner's. If your partner has this plan of doing a number of things and starting a family isn't one of them, talk to them about it. Well, in all of these plans that you have, at what point would you be interested in starting a family? You see, a lot of people take starting a family for granted. Well, of course, during that period of time, I'm going to want to start a family. I'm going to want kids. I'm going to want to live this lifestyle. What people don't realize is that it has to be planned for as well. The time it takes to be an active parent is time taken away from all of these other ventures, all of these other goals. People underestimate that. It is those people who go into it saying, well, I want this kind of career, this kind of lifestyle, I want to be involved in these type of activities, and I also want to make sure that I have time during this significant part of my life to be an active parent. Those are the people that are best able to handle the stresses and the life changes that come with these major life transitions.
What do you say, or how do you deal with expectations? Because even if you are a couple, you are still an individual first. And I feel like lots can be lost in translation about what each partner expects from the relationship.
When trying to balance the individual attitude with the couple attitude, you have to remember that there are going to be things that you may have to compromise on and things that you simply will not compromise on. It's important to discuss this. You have to talk to your partner about it, especially if you want to get more serious. If you want to get to the point where you're in a committed relationship, you have to know exactly what it is you're willing to give up and compromise on and what you're going to hold on to for dear life. If you can't even have these type of conversations, that's a sign you should not be aiming to get committed. And this is a very sad reality for people. Because they'll come to me as the relationship coach, and they'll say, how do I bring this up to my partner? And I'm thinking, if you don't even know how to even bring it up to your partner, if you don't have the open communication between you and your partner to talk about it without fear, that's the bigger issue for me. A couple that has a solid foundation for a relationship should be able to talk about things that are very uncomfortable. And if you're so worried that, well, if I bring this up to my partner might not like it, my partner might leave, my partner, well, that's a bigger issue than whatever issue you're going to talk about. If a topic of conversation is going to split you up, you might not have the solid relationship you think you do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really important for people to sit with and let that marinate. What would you say? I know you said a couple of moments ago that time isn't necessarily a factor when it comes to commitment, but it's weird because I feel like some people assign time to a relationship like, oh, you know, if we've been together for 2 years, you know, it's make it or break it time, like it's time to get engaged or not. So what do you say to those people, Frank? Does time play a factor at all, or is it really if you can talk to the person on every single level?
Yes, time does play a factor. However, time alone cannot be the only factor. It's basically saying, let's look at something non-romantic here. If the only reason you're still friends with somebody is because, well, we've always been friends. We've been friends for 20 or 30 years. We have nothing in common. We don't have anything to talk about, but we've been friends for 30 or 40 years. That to me signals, okay, they're making time the most important factor, and it's not. Time can be a good catalyst, though, to force certain conversations to the surface. For example, we've been dating for 6 months. Well, after 6 months, are we going to get exclusive? Because down the road, I want to be monogamous. Well, if you've been dating for 6 months, that's a pretty good use of time as a catalyst to just bring up the conversation. So this way, you don't end up dating for years and years aimlessly and realizing, wow, I've just wasted so much time. Time is great when you want to set a deadline, not to say, well, after 6 months, we should be engaged, or after 6 months or a year, we should be moving in together. Time is the catalyst to say, okay, we should be discussing this at this juncture. And at that point, once the deadline is reached, look, are you interested in getting engaged? Are you interested in moving in together? Are you interested in having kids? At the very least, both people know that at that particular juncture, at that particular deadline, the conversations are going to come up. If people want to be ready for that deadline, they can prepare. Well, what is it that I do want? What kind of question should I be asking my partner to see if we should get more serious or not? But that's the best use of time. But you don't say, well, we've been dating for 6 years. We may as well get married, or we may as well have kids. We may as well live together, because that is a recipe for disaster. Nobody wants to feel that the other person is there, well, just because there's nobody else and we were together long enough. They want to know, I'm with you because I want a future with you. I want to build a life with you. I want to be there to support you when you're down, and I want to be there when I'm flying high, and I want you by my side because you're the person that I want to build this future with.
Okay. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show, relationship coach Frank Kermit. You can learn more on his website, franktalks.com. Frank, you know, I think some people stay in relationships because, just sort of like you mentioned a few moments ago, that it's almost easier, you know, or there's no one else in their mind, or you know, something like that. Is it so bad to stay in a relationship with someone who isn't committed? And how do you realize if they are not? Like, let's say you really do love this person and you think they're great and you know they love you back, but you're not sure if they love you to the level that you love them.
Wow, there's so many questions there. Where do I start? The first answer to your question, should you stay in a relationship with someone who isn't as committed to you as you are to them? Make a list of everything you want in life from your relationships. If this includes marriage, living together, having children, or getting help to raise the children you may already have from a previous relationship, make a list of where you want to live, how you want to live, day to day. Make a list of all the things you want to experience. Some people want to experience, let's do something really taboo here. Some people want to experience a sexual variety lifestyle, while other people want a lifestyle that's quiet in the country and not involving too many other people. Whatever it is that you want out of life, make sure that you know what that is and that you communicate it to your partner. If you're getting your needs met and the person is giving you the level of commitment that you need, maybe not necessarily what you want, that's up to you to decide if it's worth compromising and sticking around. Is the good outweighing the bad? And if the answer is no, then no matter how good it is, it's still bad. So that's the first question. some people stay in relationships because, as you said, it is easier to stay with a person that meets some of your needs and not all, because there's always that fear. Maybe I won't find any better. Maybe I'm never going to have this kind of connection again. Well, that's true, because every time you're dealing with a new person, the connection is going to be different. It's not a question of better or worse. It's a question of difference. There's going to be things about the new person that you're going to love and things about the new person that you're not going to love. Look at couples that have been widowed and then remarry someone else. So you have people who they've had past marriages or past relationships. They're widowed, and they move on to find a new partner. It doesn't mean that their past relationships that ended with death are any worse or any better than the relationships they have now. They have to make a decision right now as to what will make them more happy and who they connect with and can continue to live with and build a future with. You don't say, well, this relationship was better than that relationship. Each relationship is different. Each connection is different. If you have an unreasonable expectation that I have to find exactly the same connection as I had with an ex of mine, well, that's so unreasonable that you're going to be disappointed. You have to take every connection as a different connection and just enjoy the qualities of it, knowing that there's going to be some things about it that you may not like, but are tolerable.
How do you get out of that, though, Frank? Because I think it's a really important point that you just brought up, because I think a lot of people are trapped by their past. Like, let's say they were in a relationship where, you know, it didn't work out, but they really had a connection with that person, and it was a really important relationship in their life. And, you know, now they're with someone else, and they love, you know, they love person B very much. And, you know, they connect on a bunch of levels. But let's say they're sort of haunted by relationship A on some level, where they just can't, you know, finish each other's sentences like they could with relationship A. How do you deal with that and move? Like, let's say you really do want to move on and be with, you know, person B, but A is haunting you a little bit, even though you don't want them to. Because I feel like that's probably a commitment issue for a lot of people. Like, they're haunted by their past a bit.
Absolutely. It's very human. It's very normal. Let's look at a few things here. When you look at any past relationship, you got to remember something. That past relationship didn't last. So for all the good that that past relationship offered, even if there was only one or two good things that you can't get over, obviously those two or three things or those great things were not enough. Because if they were enough, you would still be with that person. The fact that the relationship ended for whatever reason suggests that as great as those qualities were, there are other qualities that are more important to you. And if you have that with your new partner, then be happy with that. Yes, it's you're going to remember, oh, well, you know, I don't have the same connection with my new partner like I did with my old one. Well, if you have the unreasonable expectation that you should, that's the problem. That has nothing to do with your new partner. That's got to do with you.
Mm-hmm.
Be grateful. I mean, this is a way to find some healing here. Be grateful that you were able to experience that with somebody else. But to have the unreasonable expectation that you should only be involved with people that you have that connection with, well, you're going to end up spending a lot of time alone.
Mm-hmm.
I get the idea that, you know, we all have people we hold torches for. We all have people that we remember as, I had something special with that person. Guess what? That's something special you had with somebody. Be grateful for it. It was great. It was wonderful. But the fact that you're not there with that person right now is a sign that, as great as it was, that one quality is just not enough to build a long-term future.
Okay, perfect. Frank, thank you so much for your time on this topic. I think it's been fascinating. Thank you so much.
Kelly, this has been great. You know I'm always available to do the Kelly Alexander Show.
Excellent. That is relationship coach Frank Kermit. If you want to learn more, make sure you check out his website, franktalks.com. A big thank you going out to my guests this week, Kim Airy, Patrick Charles, Matthew Genovese, as well as Frank Kermit. Here is your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time coming from Thomas Zaz. People often say that this or that person has not yet found himself, but the self is not something one finds. It is something one creates. Have an awesome week. Thanks for hanging out. Don't forget to check out our interviews on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Also, our social media at Kay Alexander Show and Kelly Alexander Show on Facebook. And of course, you can always drop me a line, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.